Part 7, Under the Heel. Five of us were bundled onto an open truck with a couple of armed guards to be taken to the interrogation centre at Frankfurt. Going through the ruins of Stuttgart, I'll swear I didn't see one building with all its walls standing for quite 2 miles. It was like the City of London multiplied tenfold. The Daimler-Benz factory was just a shell, and the once proud railway station just a flattened mass of ruins with twisted girders and rails sticking up. Here and there were the charred embers of what had been carriages and trucks thrown around the place. Although it was 2 days since the raid, fires were fiercely burning in many places. In the centre of the city, a mob of people suddenly rushed into the street and stopped our truck. Within 10 seconds, about 50 people were scrambling all over the truck trying to get in it. We felt scared. We thought they were after our blood, but apparently it was the transport they wanted, and the guards were unable to stop them crowding on. In darkness and detouring around cratered streets, we eventually reached the nearest serviceable Bahnhof railway station in a town 10 miles north of Stuttgart and were ushered into a crowded waiting room. We didn't relish the idea of appearing in our uniforms amongst a crowd of bombed out and infuriated Stuttgartians, who soon realised who we were and began to murmur and nudge one another. We were pretty uneasy, but things got even worse when a big, burly Prussian army type caught hold of us, shone his torch on each one of us in turn, and was obviously inciting the crowd to lynch us. The crowd were almost on the point of doing so when our guards returned with a girl porter who, in perfect English, asked us to come away and led us into the comparative safety of the station master's office. Next morning, a train took us to the outskirts of Frankfurt. We debarked, and half an hour's march brought us to Oberursel, the interrogation centre. What a place!
Gordon's contemporary diary was lost, but in 2010 he wrote the following description from memory. Happily, his diary later came to light, and we will read extracts from it later, but his description explains much about Stalag Luft III and his life there, so we will read this in full.
We were put into a largish room with 30 or 40 others, roughly half and half British and Americans, who immediately started talking amongst themselves about details of their missions. We kept our conversation to small talk, as we had been warned that such a place would be bugged. After being searched, I was put into solitary confinement and left there for 4 or 5 days, seeing no one and receiving only meagre rations. Eventually, I was taken into an interview room and greeted by a very affable German officer with a plate of luscious cakes and cigarettes on the table. In perfect English, he tried to get me talking about myself. I averted his blandishments and stuck to my name, rank and number, which was not easy, having been in solitary for 5 days. Another time was more threatening. To aid in evasion, I had ripped off my brevet and rank markings, so I was told that as far as they were concerned, I could be a spy. Only the previous week, somebody just like me had been shot by the Gestapo. I had to prove who I was. The next move to try and break me was to leave me in my cell for another 3 days, but alternate the temperature every few hours from boiling hot to freezing cold. Even this failed to get anything out of me. Next, we were sorted. All RAF officers were sent to Stalag Luft III, situated near Sagan in southeast Germany, requiring a long train journey with frequent interruptions, presumably because of bombing attacks. On arrival at the camp gates, there was a crowd of Kregis looking out to see who was in the new intake, and I spotted the chap who was my roommate at ITW when I first joined the RAF. Stalag Luft III, Bellaria, was made up of 4 compounds, 3 to the west of Sagan, and Bellaria, which was to be my home for a while, to the east. I will try and describe what life was like.
The compound consisted of about 10 huts. each containing three or four rooms, with about 15 to a room. Twice a day at 9 and 4, we were called out on appel, when we all had to parade outside for roll call. There used to be the odd baiting of the Germans or goons by moving people around, so the goons sometimes found too many individuals. Apart from these, we are more or less left to ourselves, except for the occasional spot inspection. We had a senior British officer, SBO, and an admin officer, and a couple of committees. One committee that no longer existed when I was there was the Escape Committee. Earlier that year, there had been the Great Escape, as per the film, from the North Compound, and, as is well known, 50 of those who got out and were subsequently captured were shot on Hitler's orders. He ordered that anyone caught escaping would be shot on sight. So what had been a hobby of digging tunnels with no more than a couple of weeks in the cooler or solitary confinement now became suicidal, so such exercises were now verboten. Food. The Germans only provided very meagre rations, a few slices of bread. Sometimes we had sandwiches, barley porridge for breakfast, stew of a sort for lunch, some potatoes, and that was about it. Certainly not enough to keep healthy young men really fit. Fortunately, the Red Cross provided food parcels. The chaotic state of transport in Germany meant that we were restricted to one between two, but this provided a lifeline and some variety in our eating. A lot of things were in tins, which were not wasted, but craftily turned into cooking utensils, with which we could cook different dishes over a little fire made from chippings from our bedboards. For instance, we crushed up the biscuits provided in the parcels, mixed with butter and sugar to make a fairly acceptable cake. But despite all this, we were still desperately underfed, and a large part of one's thoughts were all about the wonderful food we would get when we got home. Our guards, German officers or non-combatants, or goons as we called them, were almost all older blokes who were fed up with the war and Hitler. Those who smoked found cigarettes in short supply, but we had plenty from the Red Cross parcels and used them to bribe the goons to bring in various things, like parts to make a radio, etc.
The Germans provided us with a daily bulletin from OKW, which of course was completely one-sided. But somewhere in the compound, somebody had built a radio, and every day a short bulletin from the BBC was smuggled around to all the huts. One of the huts was converted into an assembly hall, which could be a theatre, and there were several plays. Somehow, presumably by bribing the guards, they managed all the costumes, etc., and the productions were highly entertaining. There were also various classes run by experts in their subject. I started one to try and learn something about calculus. One of our main problems was boredom. At the NCO's camp, they were often taken outside to do various jobs, which at least relieved the boredom, but as officers, we weren't allowed to do that. Our main occupation was either reading or playing cards. We took turns to stooge, that is, to be the day's dog's body, cooking, cleaning, etc., and keeping watch for any goons around. Outside, we had a large parade ground, which provided a place for some exercise and a chat to your mates from other huts. Circuit bashing, we called it. There was a certain amount of sports gear provided by the YMCA, including skating boots, which came in useful when the freezing weather set in. The Red Cross provided various items of basic clothing, but we mainly lived in our battle dresses. I think this gives a good picture of our life, which might sound cosy, but the shortage of food and never knowing when or if we might see home again made life far from happy. What it did show was how well a bunch of people of all types, nationalities and ranks, we had every rank from group captain to pilot officer, could survive by all mucking in together. There were often heated squabbles, particularly with the card players, but they were all over in a flash and forgotten almost immediately.
During my life up until then, I had frequently suffered from earache, and I experienced a very severe attack at Bellaria. So bad that I reported it to the Germans, who took me to their medical quarters, where a doctor performed a small operation, and I have never had a serious attack since. You may wonder what happened to the rest of our crew. Jim, our bomb aimer, was with me, and we heard later from the Germans that, sadly, Ted, our skipper, had died in hospital. What of, though, we never found out. We had no news of the others, who were NCOs, and therefore in another camp. But later we discovered they were all fit and well. There was one very frightening episode, though. One day in January, when we were called out to afternoon roll call, we found that the goon boxes, the watchtowers, instead of housing just two goons, were occupied by seven or eight fully armed guards. This naturally made us apprehensive, but it passed off without anything happening. Later, we understood that, in view of the Dresden raid, Hitler had ordered all RAF prisoners to be shot. But fortunately, Goering, the Luftwaffe leader, persuaded him otherwise.
We rejoin Gordon's contemporary diary in Stalag Luft 3 on the evening of his arrival.
In the evening, we went to the camp theatre to see the last performance of The Astonished Ostrich. And it was us who were truly astonished by the high standard of the production, both as regards acting and scenery, an excellent piece of entertainment. November the 23rd. News continues to be very good. Our troops in the outskirts of Strasbourg and east of Saarburg. Much speculation on how much longer it will last. Some optimists taking 10 to 1 against it being over in 3 weeks. November the 28th. News very good. We are at the Rhine in Strasbourg, and Russians are in big offensive.
December the 19th. Christmas parcels. For Christmas week, we are each to get 2/3 of an American Christmas parcel and 1/3 of an ordinary one. The contents of the Christmas parcel are also published. Pretty good selection. First of new American parcels distributed today. Much gnashing of teeth that D-bars are left out in favour of cocoa and Spam in favour of meat and veg stew. Also sardines in place of salmon. Went to classical music concert in the evening, which I quite enjoyed. December the 20th. Noodles for sweet today for the first time. Very much like macaroni, tastier than barley. December the 21st. Christmas cake mix, great excitement all round. First part cooked and smelt very good. Bags of mail in the mess, some of it as recent as the 5th of November. December the 23rd. Got back late for dinner and found they left me no sweet, bags of panic. I made up by having an extra slice of toast for supper. One of the happiest evenings since I've been a Craigie. The Christmas parcels arrived, 12 of them. Bags of sweets, nuts, fruit, cigarettes, tobacco, games, etc. distributed around, and bashing started immediately. The Canadians also contributed 1.5 ounces of Cadbury's milk chocolate apiece.